found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez broadcasting live as we do every weekday morning, Monday through Friday at 9 o'clock Pacific, right here on LATalkRadio.com, Channel 2. Then later on in the day, you may download and listen on demand. The podcast was posted at MariaSanchezShow.com, TheMariaSanchezShow.com, as well as at LATalkRadio.com. It is Wednesday, July 10th. We are live, as we mentioned, and on the program this morning, George Ferrell. We've got an expert on human behavior, and he is the best-selling author of a series of books included with the title Strong Black Man, and that also includes Angry Black Man's Guide to Success. He's going to speak with us about that, as well as his take on the George Zimmerman trial, because there's some new news about that this morning, about what the judge ruled this morning about Trayvon Martin's cell phone texts on fighting and the defense animation depicting the fight between Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. And then later on the program, we have a representative from the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library talking about an event that's happening next week, and we wanted to help promote that. So if there's something that's going on in your community, it doesn't have to be local here because we are worldwide, you please contact us. If you go to MariaSanchezShow.com, it shows you where you can reach me. I prefer emails because that helps me look at the schedule and then figure things out. So please feel free to go ahead and do so. In the news today, Tsarnaev's arraignment is scheduled for this afternoon in federal court in Boston. Survivors of the Boston Marathon bombing will be able to attend the trial. Space is limited, but is being reserved in the main courtroom for the victims' families, as well as they're setting aside an overflow courtroom to broadcast the hearing for the media. Reporters and spectators began lining up this morning at 7:30 a.m. That's Eastern time, so that's early, since it's not happening this afternoon. And, of course, Tsarnaev has been charged with using a weapon of mass destruction in the bombings that killed three people and wounded more than 260. This is going to be his first public appearance since he was arrested April 19th, because his initial court appearance took place at a hospital where he was recovered from the injuries that he suffered in the shootout with the police the day before in the Boston suburb of Watertown. So he's accused of killing three people, Martin Richard 8, Crystal Marie Campbell 29, and Lingzi Liu 23, as well as they are saying that he's suspected of killing the MIT officer Sean Collier days later while they were on the run. So the indictment also said that sometime before the bombing, Tsarnaev downloaded internet material from Islamic extremists that advocated violence against the perceived enemies of Islam. Also in the news this morning is further information about the pilots and what happened with the Asiana crash on Saturday in San Francisco. The National Transportation Safety Board chairwoman, Deborah Hansen, has said that the pilots were relying on automatic equipment, which is an auto-throttle system, to maintain airspeed and did not realize the plane was flying too slowly until it was just 200 feet above the ground. She also said that two flight attendants were ejected from the plane after its tail hit the seawall in front of the runway and was torn off. Both were found injured but alive on the side of the runway. Now, here's something that's interesting. The South Korean's airline flight crew members were not tested for drugs or alcohol after the crash, which is a requirement for U.S.-based pilots involved in accidents. The plane was traveling 25% below its targeted airspeed as it came in for the landing. And while she has declined to speculate, this is her third debriefing, by the way, since it occurred on Saturday. Much of the information released by the NTSB suggests pilot error as the main focus of the investigation. So the pilot, as you may have heard, in charge of the landing of the plane on Saturday, was in training on the 777 and was about halfway through the process. Seated next to him was a co-pilot who was on his first flight as an instructor. Now, both pilots were experienced, although they had not flown together before. Three of the four pilots on board were in the cabin during the landing, although only two could see the runway. The Airline Pilots Association International has come out saying that they're not happy with the handling of the investigation because the agency is releasing too much information too quickly, which could lead to wrong conclusions and compromise safety. And the NTSB chairwoman, Deborah Hersman, says, "We work for the traveling public. We feel it's important to show our work." So talk about full, you know, revealing, if you will. They're saying, too, that one of the two Chinese teenage students who died may have been run over by the emergency vehicle, which is just horrific. And the local coroner has not yet released the autopsy results showing the cause of death. Asiana Airlines chief executive arrived in San Francisco yesterday to meet with the U.S. investigators. And the NTSB chairman also confirmed witnesses' accounts that at least one emergency escape chute had deployed inside the aircraft and trapped a flight attendant. The one pilot who was sitting in the cabin worked to free her, and she was eventually freed and hospitalized with serious injuries. So that's all new information released at the press conference yesterday. And here's something about what the recession has affected as well. And this is according to recent analysis by the Pew Institute. Since 2007, where there are a record number of 4.3 million births in the United States, that number has been declining, with there being just over 4 million in 2012, the lowest number since 1998. So analysts are saying that the birth rate is dictated by the economy, and the national birth rate in the United States hit an all-time low in 2011 and remained stagnant in 2012. So a senior writer at the Pew Research Center says, when times are up, births go up. When times are bad, births go down. So there were 63 births per 1,000 women aged 15 to 44 in 2012. That's according to the Center for Disease Control. That's down from 69 births per 1,000 women in that same age bracket in 2007. They're saying other than the economy, there are other factors that are at play as well, financial insecurity being one of them. Many women are opting to postpone motherhood. And the higher the education level with a woman, the later in life they're giving birth, and they're having less children overall, and that seems to have been consistent over the past few years. Some couples are actually missing their window of opportunity to have a baby because they feel that they never are going to be financially secure enough to commit to having a child. And no wonder, if you pay attention to this statistic, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that a middle-aged two-parent family will spend $235,000 raising a child that does not include college tuition. So what was I thinking? When I was growing up, after I got over the fact that I wasn't going to be a nun, I was going to be a career woman, wife, and mother. And then when I realized that I wanted to, you know, I couldn't not be a mother and be on this planet, I was going to have six children. And I didn't have my first till I was late 20s. And so by that time, I was like, okay, four is probably going to be enough. I'm the eldest of four. My first husband, who's the father of my four children, is third of four. So four kind of seemed natural to us. Plus, the logistics involved as you actually have multiple children is a little bit daunting. I always had two in cribs, and after I nursed them, two on bottles, and I ended up having four children in 5 years. My eldest was five when my fourth child was born. And forget the emotional and the physical, what it exacts from you. The financial is something staggering. My children all went to Catholic school, so in addition to an education, we paid for that education, and then two of my children have graduated from college and who are in college, so it doesn't seem like it ever stops. But the birth rate among single women drops substantially, as did the rate for young women in their teens and early 20s. So yay, that's good news. However, the birth rate actually increased slightly for older women in their early 40s and remained the same for women in their 30s. And they're saying the reason for that is that older women are generally more financially secure. And for women in their 40s, the ticking of a biological clock is often louder than the economic concerns, of which I have a girlfriend that has done that herself. She's in her mid to late 30s. She's divorced. She didn't have anybody special in her life. She knew she wanted to be a mother. And she said to me, I just felt like time was running out. So she went and got artificially inseminated. And she is about 6 months pregnant. She just found out that she's having a girl. And she's doing it on her own. So the final conclusion to this Pew research is the net effect in the past has been that if you have the same amount of babies, they're just born a little bit later. So in other words, when times are good, women have more babies. When times are bad, they pull back, but the average seems the same. But they're saying that because this trend has been going on for longer than anticipated, there's usually a bounce back, but whether or not there's going to be a full recovery, that's probably not going to be the case. So interesting to know how finances, which they should. And, you know, it's glad to know that the gals that are single in their teens and in their 20s are delaying childbirth. That's really awesome. So now we'd like to bring George Farrell onto the program. And George is going to be speaking with us about the Strong Black Man series of books, including The Angry Black Man's Guide to Success, Core Anger, and how you can use that to channel into ambition, and his take on what's going on with the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman trial.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning, George. This is Maria Sanchez. It's good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
Good morning, good afternoon, Buenos tardes. How are you?
You're going to lay some Espanol on me, huh? I'm excellent. George, before we get into your take on what's going on with the George Zimmerman trial, let's speak about your very interesting background. First, you wanted to speak about your series of books, The Strong Black Man, and how you can channel anger into drive and ambition?
Yes, thank you so much for having me on your show today. I have written a series of books. They're called The Strong Black Man and Angry Black Man's Guide to Success. They're available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, paperback and e-edition. And what they talk about is sometimes there's an anger within people, and it can be caused by situation, by family, and that anger can cause self-destructive behavior. So what I talk about and teach young men is how to take that anger, how to take that disappointment that's in your life, turn it into drive, ambition, and determination. Don't let it eat you up. Don't let it lead to drug usage. Don't let it lead to alcohol usage. Don't self-destruct. Don't beat yourself. Because the thing that really causes a lot of disappointment in people's lives is they beat themselves. So I talk about how to turn that around, how to focus it, and how to set goals.
So do you go into why they experience anger, or you don't care, you just say, you've got this anger, now let's do something with it that's productive and constructive?
Well, we discuss different ways. Some of it can be a family member or someone close to you saying, oh, you're not going to amount to much, you're not going to be a good person. It could be a situation that you're in that you don't think is fair. You may not have a two-parent family. You may not be born into a wealthy family. All those things can turn anger, especially when you're in a consumer-oriented society where it shows everyone happy and dancing and the commercials look great and you're not having that lifestyle. Some people turn that inside and turn that into an internal destructive device.
George, does your life have anything to do with that? Did you
Oh, I'm sure it has a lot to do with it.
Share your journey with us, please.
Well, I had a great journey. I can't complain about my life. It's very rich. It's very happy. But there are times in your life when you may go through a self-destructive behavior. But it's not just my life. The President of the United States, President Clinton, was gliding along, had a great second term going, and he participates in behavior that becomes self-destructive. It's not just black men that go through this. A lot of people go through this where they just self-destructive. They just all of a sudden turn to behaviors, alcohol, drugs, marital affairs, things like that, that just can cause self-destructive behaviors and take you off the path to where you were going. So it's not just my life. I use the lives of a lot of other people who are successful.
And George, is there a series of steps? Obviously, identifying the fact that you've got anger issues or unresolved anger must be one of the first ones, I would imagine.
Yeah, there is a series of steps. The first step you have to do is you've got to focus on where you want to go, where you are now, and where you want to go, and take action. That's the first step. There's six steps to the levels of success. The first step is taking action, making that list of those items that you want to accomplish, and keeping those focused, not letting people drive you off of it. The second step is when you decide that you want to take action, letting other people know that you want to take action. Some people will actually help you, and some people will get in your way. And you'll be able to identify the people who don't want you to be successful because they'll tell you you won't amount to anything. You use that as another anger point to turn things around. There's a lot of that internal anger and external anger. So your first step is identifying. The second step is asking for help, letting people know where you're going. The third step is as you start to become successful or you move in that direction, other people will help you, and you'll start to achieve that level of success. And that's where it becomes dangerous. That's where the self-destructive turn in, because the more successful you become, your body language changes, your tone changes, you're more positive. That's when negative people actually start to leech and attach themselves to you. Mm. That's when more women will find you attractive. If you're a married man, women who never talked to you before will now talk to you because your body language, your aura is stronger. So you've got to recognize those signals. You may have never stopped in a bar to have a drink before, but all of a sudden some business partners say, hey, let's go get a drink. And you wouldn't have done this before. You would have stayed focused. But now you start to have a drink every day where you wouldn't have before. So these are the small things that I teach people to look out for. Is the third level where you're becoming successful. The fourth level is the self-destructive part that comes into your life and starts to tear you down. Then,
Do we become self-destructive because we're afraid of success, or because we don't know how to handle success, and therefore we're going to be our own worst enemy and trip ourselves up before somebody else does?
You're absolutely right. A lot of times people are afraid of success. They don't know what's coming next. They've never experienced before, and the negative forces come into their life, and they fail to recognize that people that are coming into their lives now didn't help them get there and aren't going to help them get to the next step. So sometimes we become self-destructive because that internal anger comes in again and says, oh, you're not supposed to be here. I'll give you a great example. The NBA championship with LeBron James, right? Mm-hmm. After he won his second trophy, mm-hmm. he made a very interesting comment. And this is on YouTube if you want to look at it. He says, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm from Ohio. I'm from the inner city. My name is LeBron James. I'm not supposed to be here. That right there shows his core anger. What drove LeBron James is that he wasn't supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
He's now an NBA champion twice over, and the first thing he says after getting that second championship is a lot of people didn't like it. A lot of people didn't think I could make it, but my core anger kept me driving. I'm saying to America, I'm from the inner city. I'm from Ohio. I'm Cincinnati. I'm not supposed to be here. And he let the world know, I'm LeBron James. This is what it took. The core anger that drives me is that I'm from the inner city. So we can use that to drive ourselves, or we can use it to destroy ourselves. LeBron James now has to be careful of self-destructive behaviors.
Now, when he said that, I was touched by that too, because it's like, look at me. In fact, I heard him say, if I can do it, you can do it kind of thing. Like there was a subtext to his message. And I hear what you're saying about anger. I've always found anger to have negative connotations, but in my chat with you this morning, I believe what you're saying is that you can use anger to fuel you forward without it being destructive.
Correct. You can use it to fuel you. It's not always a negative emotion. You have to learn to channel it and use it like LeBron James used it to reach his goal. Now, what about the kid that's not an athlete? Those are the children that I like to reach. The ones who they don't have music talent or they don't have athletic talent, those children and those youngsters don't have anyone to teach these skills to them. And that's who I like to reach, the young adults who are just your average student, your C student, and nobody's pushing them. Nobody's telling them how to use their anger. And those are the people we have to reach because those are the Trayvon Martins. Those are the kids who are almost good, almost bad, not really doing anything too bad, not really doing anything too good. But we've got to reach those children and turn their anger into positive activities.
Do you use the word anger when you're speaking to youngsters?
Yes, I do, because they
do you?
They have that anger, yes. I don't sugarcoat it. They're angry. A lot of rap stars rap about anger and singers rap about anger, but I use that word because that's what they're feeling. That's the emotion they feel when they're in a situation that they don't know how to channel. They're feeling anger. It's inside of them. It burns.
Mm-hmm. And now what is the fifth step?
Oh, the fifth step after self-destruction is recreation. Once you achieve that level of success and you're happy with yourself, you can't sit there and not do it. You have to find another challenge, because once you've achieved what you thought you're going to achieve and you've got there, you've got to set another goal. And you have to start the process over and over and over again. You can't sit on your laurels, as they say, because once you sit there and you think you've made it, you haven't made it. So you've always got to look for another goal, another thing in life, something else you want to achieve, or just improve on your prior accomplishments. So that's the other level where after you get through the self-destructive part, mm-hmm. You recognize that, hey, I'm starting to slip a little bit. This is not going well. I'm starting to take my eye off the prize, not do the things that got me here. You have to find another goal so that you don't get lazy, so to speak.
Now, could that goal not be to mentor or to set up a philanthropic organization or to give back or to pay it forward?
Yes, the goal could be to pay it forward. It could be to build a philanthropic organization. It could be a lot of things. One of my goals is to actually one day actually build a city or a village where I can bring children and reward them with a passport, because I think one of the things that children need and to become great U.S. citizens, you need a passport. I think every child, every young adult should have a passport, and they should take a trip out of the U.S. and then back to the U.S. so they can see how great this country is, but also see the opportunities not only in the U.S. but around the world. So I'm kind of working toward building an organization that will reward children and young adults with trips outside the U.S. for 90 days, up to 90 days,
wow.
And then bring them back and show them, hey, the U.S. is great, but there's some great opportunities. We're now, because we're so connected with the web and the internet, and I'm in Washington, D.C., and you're in Los Angeles, and we're doing a live show, mm-hmm. We can be anywhere in the world right now. We've got to show our young people, let's go worldwide. Let's really move around the globe and really use our influence, because the hip-hop generation is the number one influence in the United States. We heard that from First Lady and the President when they went to Africa, that a young mm-hmm. lady got up and started singing, I'm forgetting the singer's name, but started singing other music from the U.S. to her. So we're a global influence. It's time for us to really travel outside the U.S., see what's great about the U.S., and to channel our anger in positive ways.
Do you have partners in the United States that would like to have your vision accomplished? Because it's sounds like it's very noble and important.
Yeah, we do have a lot of partners. I work with a lot of college professors that reach out, that follow our blog. We have about thousands of people on my blog, which is georgefarrell.blogspot.com, and also on our Facebook page. And a lot of people contribute, and we do it not as an official organization, but every once in a while we get a kid who's coming out of the U.S., and we make sure that they're in the right places. And I prefer Costa Rica, Panama, and Nicaragua because they're not too far away. And we have those kids experience travel outside the U.S. and then travel back in the U.S.
I love the challenge. I'd like to work with you on making that happen more. But sixth step.
Yes. The sixth step, again, starting all over. I may have missed a step. The first step is the vision. The second step, doing it. The third step is achieving it. The fourth step is the success. The fifth step is avoiding the self-destructive behavior, the fifth step. And the sixth step is recreativity.
Okay, great.
Recreating it all. And it's outlined in the book, The Angry Black Man's Guide to Success, where I go through the six steps.
Now, obviously, angry people in general and angry women could avail themselves. It doesn't have anything to do with race, really, right?
No, it doesn't have anything to do with race. But I was trying to reach a younger group of people, like I said, that may be ignored, not the athletes, not the good kids that are getting the A's and B's, but those middle students. I wanted to reach those kids, and I was a pretty decent student, but I wanted to reach those kids who are not athletic, who don't have a coach to pull their coattails. I want to reach those students and those kids that may be forgotten, that BC student, that average kid that may be forgotten.
Let's talk about the George Zimmerman trial now, because today the judge ruled this morning that Trayvon Martin's cell phone texts on fighting can't be admissible, or the defense animation depicting the pipe based on somebody's whatever's imagination is my guess. It's nobody videotaped it. What is race important in this trial?
Well, race started this trial, unfortunately. And here's my concern as a parent. When I see one child walking down the street, I never become so concerned that I would want to follow them and become aggressive toward them. If I see one child walking down the street at night in the rain, I'm probably more concerned for their safety than that they're a suspect or that they're a whatever
somebody
his term I don't want to use on the radio.
Right.
I mean, that's my concern is, what is the thought process, and hopefully more people don't have this thought process that one child walking down the street is a threat to them. That is so scary to a parent that your child could be walking down the street and someone just says, oh, look at that suspect, I don't recognize him. I would be more concerned for the child's safety or whether the child was lost or if it's a neighbor's friend or even if I'm in a gated community or a high-end community. I can't imagine seeing one person walking down the street and being so suspicious of them.
So you believe that George Zimmerman targeted him, basically, profiled him?
I'm sure George Zimmerman profiled him, and that's what started this whole thing. His interpretation of this young man walking down the street, where as a parent who has children, and I think you have a few,
if your child's
walking down the street and they have a hoodie on or they have a hat on, would someone see them as a suspect, no matter what the neighborhood, or if they're going off to college and they're off college campus, is someone going to see them, one child? Now, 10 kids walking down the street laughing or whatever, you might be a little suspicious, but one person walking down the street, I just don't see it. And I don't see why the altercation actually started.
So what do you think about the trial itself? How is it going? Do you think that the memory of Trayvon Martin is being represented appropriately and respectfully?
I think the judge is doing a great job. I think the animation should not have been admitted because it's hearsay. It's based upon hearsay. It's not based upon fact. I think that was a good ruling. I'm not sure about the text, but I think the judge is doing a good job. Last night, the judge was there until 10 p.m. hearing motions. This morning, they started on time. I've been watching and following the trial like everyone else very closely. I can't say which way this trial is going to go. I can tell you this, but if this law is not corrected, this action will actually fall back to the Florida legislature. This law needs to be corrected. Until this law is corrected, a lot of people are not going to be safe in Florida because anyone can just say they're standing their ground, whether they're in front of their house or not. This law needs to be corrected to say if someone is on my property, maybe then I can stand my ground. But if I'm just out in the street and I feel that someone's threatening me, I have the right to shoot them, I think the law needs to be fixed. And I think that's going to be the lesson of Trayvon Martin, that you can't pass these laws that are too loose and create a wild, wild west.
The thing is, though, that if my contention is if Trayvon Martin hadn't been black, that we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
You're absolutely correct.
It wouldn't be televised. It wouldn't be national news. So that's the part that I don't understand necessarily is, in other words, if he had been white, why and he's not, why is it captivating us? Because we assume wrongdoing?
No, I don't think we assume wrongdoing. I think the mistake was made by the police department, the police detective, is that Mr. Zimmerman should have been arrested immediately, not months later. There are several things that went wrong. I mean, Mr. Martin was a John Doe for several days. The police department was very lax in notification of looking for the young man's next of kin. They were very lax in making arrests. That's the part that really scares a lot of parents, because the police department in Sanford, and I actually know where Sanford is. I've been to Sanford. It has a beautiful marina. It's a nice little town. It's right next to Orlando, by the way.
Mm.
So it's also next to Eatonville, which is a historically black town.
Uh-huh.
But I think what a lot of people are afraid of, and it shouldn't have turned racial. It never should have turned racial. The police department turned it racial because they did a very bad job in the initial days of this investigation.
And then what is your take on the alleged star witness for the prosecution, Rachel Gentile?
Well, Rachel
Gentile.
How do you
think she did?
I think she came off, she is what she is, that's what I can say. And she's a 17-year-old. She's a product of her environment, and she's a product of Florida public schools, which gives you an idea of the state of Florida public schools.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's what she is. She's not.
But anger seems to have been part of her demeanor.
Anger is part of her demeanor. She's in unfamiliar surroundings, and we got to understand that she's probably had a lot of police attention in the last few days, and maybe before this event, that wasn't favorable. I mean, in her community, the police probably aren't seen as friends or people who are going to mean you any good or going to protect your property. Her community, there's probably a lot of police containment and outright police harassment. You got to understand, there are police officers in her school, most likely, that are very hostile to the students. So her background and her reference for law enforcement is probably not a healthy one.
Uh-huh. But what's interesting is that it was an attorney that was, you know, I guess you could say he was a little bit aggressive, but it wasn't a police officer that was interrogating her, although she obviously had been debriefed.
No, he was aggressive, but that's his job. His job is to make her seem that she's not credible. He mm-hmm. did a good job doing what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to take any advantage that he can and make it seem like you cannot believe this person. She's not one of us. We need to make her seem less than human. In the same way with Trayvon Martin, we need to make him seem less than human. Like it was all right for him to be shot. It's all right for her not to be believed. That's his job, and he's doing a good job of that. Which way this trial goes is anybody's guess.
And what is your overall, George, what do you think is the prognosis for America in general in terms of our issues with racism and even sexism and that sort of thing? Are do you see improvement? Are we growing? Are we?
I tell you what,
there's
a lot of improvement. There's a lot of improvement. There's a lot of tolerance. There's a lot more acceptance of gay marriage and things like that, which wouldn't have been accepted 10 or 20 years ago. I think America is moving forward on several fronts. On the race issue, I think we're probably polarizing a lot more than we need to be. This is going to need to be the leadership of Florida needs to step forward. As a matter of fact, the NAACP annual convention is in Orlando right now. The leaders of the NAACP, which is the National Association of Advancement of Colored People, need to step forward and say, look, we want to have a healing time. It's time for, while they're in Orlando, while they're in Florida, they need to call for healing. They need to put down the Democrat label, the Republican label, the black label, the white label, ask for the governor of Florida to come forward, and they need to just hold hands and say kumbaya. It's time for everybody to put it down. This could be a learning lesson, but we can't have an organization here that's just going to come and talk about issues without talking about those issues with an organization over there. And this will be a great time this weekend when the NAACP is meeting in Orlando for the governor of Florida and other folks from Florida to say, look, we want to solve this problem in Florida because it's going to cost them money. I mean, a lot of people aren't going to feel safe going to Disney right now.
Could you email them, please? Because that would be such cathartic, because you know that the police department is getting ready for some upheaval and hopefully not rioting and all that sort of thing. If you could be preemptive in that, and if it came from you, I think that would go a long way to help shape their agenda for the weekend.
Well, that's going to be my next call to the governor's office, to call for him to step forward, to show some leadership on this issue while the NAACP is in town, because this verdict could come out before the start of this convention.
Exactly.
Which starts on the 13th, and that may not be good. But some of the people, the leadership of that organization, the leadership of the governor, the president who wants to play a role in race, and race relations in this country, he needs to come forward. Or his wife, or whoever they want to send, everybody needs to come together on this one. And we need to say, hey, we're going to get away from this black, white, Latin issue. We're going to get along.
But if you could ask the NAACP to invite the governor, then it's not like he's inviting himself and putting himself where he may not be wanted.
Well, I can ask.
I'm imbuing you with great power and authority. I really think that you should do it.
I will ask, and I say, look, you need to invite the governor. You need to be shown shaking hands. This needs to be something that the national media picks up on this while the attention is there.
Yep.
That you guys are going to say, we're going to have this. And this is one of the other things that was in my background. I didn't say it. I was a commissioner for the Florida Commission on Human Relations, where we used to solve a lot of these issues, and I was very proactive in terms of looking at companies and businesses and saying, hey, let's solve this problem before it becomes a problem. So I do have a background in human relations. I was a Florida Commissioner on Human Relations when I was a resident of Florida, and I would like to see some action from the governor's office and from the NAACP where they come together and they solve this issue together.
Get on that hotline of yours, George, and make it
happen.
I'm
getting on that hotline.
So thank you.
And I'm
going to
tell him I'm not angry. I'm not calling as an angry man. I'm calling for peace.
I have healed. George, when we post our podcast later today, we'll put your Blogspot information on there as well so folks can follow you. And I cannot thank you enough for the conversation. It's been delightful.
Oh, I'll come back anytime. I love your show. I think you do a great job out there in Los Angeles. And hopefully no one will ever see your children as a suspect walking down the street. And that's the scary part as a parent who has children, that someone doesn't see a child and say, oh, even if their house was robbed last week, I still don't understand how that one person was seen as a suspect. That's where it started. If it was a white child, that same thing. Thank you. The books, The Angry Black Man's Guide to Success, Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Excellent.
And Ms. Sanchez, you are wonderful, and I love your show.
Thank you so much, George. Take care. Have a great day. And I expect the bat line to be called. I think that's an awesome opportunity. So George Farrell, and we, again, will post his contact information when we post the podcast so that you can listen on demand and at your leisure. There are free apps so that you can download the podcast to your iPhone and your Android and your tablet. So please, if you haven't availed yourself of that, do so. We're next going to visit with the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, and we're going to be speaking with them about an event that they're hosting next week so that we can help promote it. And her name is Jennifer Mandel, and Jennifer's going to be visiting with us shortly.
Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
It's Maria Sanchez. Welcome. How are you this morning?
Thank you. I'm fine. Thank you.
Excellent. Jennifer, let's talk about the blood drive that's honoring Marilyn McNitt. And let's first speak about the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, because a lot of folks may have wanted to go and want to make a trip to go, but haven't done so yet. Because I know you've got a special, I forget what it's called, but it's on Lincoln going on at the moment. And it lasts through the summer.
Yes, we do. We have an exhibit on Lincoln right now. It's a fabulous exhibit. There's a lot of exciting things. And yeah, people are coming out to give blood. They're going to get a coupon for free admission to the museum. So it's a really cool thing.
So that's, I mean, we were wanting to promote the community blood drive, and it's Wednesday, July 17th, so it's actually a week exactly from today, from 10 in the morning to 4 p.m. But why don't you tell everyone what they get, which is, because, you know, when I think about blood donations, it's being selfless. It's paying it forward, because you never know what life you're going to be saving and where it's going to go, because it gets aggregated, and then whoever has the need gets it. This one is honoring a specific individual, but obviously it's going, blood is universal. So for giving on Wednesday, July 17th, what do they get?
Well, aside from what you just mentioned, which is the, you know, the honor of being able to save someone's life, they also are going to be able to, you know, get, like I said, the coupon for free admission to the library. The Red Cross is offering 2 tickets to the Laugh Factory and a coupon for, I think, a free appetizer for Chili, mm-hmm. for Chili's restaurant. Was that what you were wondering about?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So here you go. You go to give blood, and then you get back. So it's a win-win-win.
It is a win.
Because you're paying it forward. It's a win because you're actually getting something for your efforts, and it's a win because it's putting valuable resources into the blood supply, which is traditionally always low during the summer months.
That's what I've heard, yeah. So this is a great time to come out, and I hope anyone who's blessed with good health who's listening can come on out, make some time. And the other thing, if I can mention it, is we're also going to have a table for the Be the Match bone marrow registry.
Oh, good.
So people who are interested in that will be able to get information and, I believe, actually do the swab and sign up if they want to take that step.
The other thing that people may not know about when you donate blood now, you get all kinds of information about your blood, not only your blood type, if you may or may not know that, but they do run tests on the blood, obviously, to make sure that it's able to be donatable. And my understanding is that they give you numbers. Well, you get your blood pressure checked before you're allowed to give, and then I believe they give you cholesterol. So it's almost like a mini physical, if you will, and it's, of course, for free. So the other thing is, I tried to give last month because my Rotary Club had a blood drive, and I was disqualified because of a country that I had traveled to last year in the last 12 months because of the malaria exposure. So in other words, if you go and you have every intention to, there may be reasons that you're not allowed to give, but they'll you know that because they pull out this book and they ask for when you were there and what country you were in and et cetera. So it's really comprehensive, and I'm a huge fan of the American Red Cross. So that's why it's like, this is an amazing opportunity to help our community. Do you want to speak a little bit about Marilyn McNitt too?
Sure. Jenny? Marilyn she's been an inspiration. She's the reason why I wanted to organize this blood drive. When I heard about her diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia, I was shocked, as anyone would be. And when I started to learn about the disease and how it's treated, I realized that patients who are undergoing that treatment may need over 100 pints of blood to get them through the process. So I just realized, I think I had a bit of an epiphany and said, whoa, this is something that one person can't take care of. This person, you know, it's not, their family can't just go and give blood, and it really takes a community to get someone with a disease like this through the treatment process, and that's just one person. So, you know, there are people all over this country who are suffering from blood disorders and who need transfusions, people who are in accidents. It's just a vital thing. So I wanted to do the blood drive to honor Marilyn and to, you know, let her know that she's got a friend out here who's thinking of her.
And my dad is suffering from all kinds of complications, and he gets platelets regularly because of some of the maladies in his blood. So I'm directly affected by the selflessness of others who are giving, which is not why we're talking, but it's you never know is the point.
You never know, absolutely. And look at all those people in Boston who were horribly injured. The train crash that we had a few years ago, we actually had a blood drive in response to that. All of those people who are victims need blood. It is such a selfless thing to come out and to donate either here or any place.
So, Jenny, you want to give the rundown again?
Sure. Sure. The blood drive is happening at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. It begins at 10. It's going to go all day. You come on down if you sign up to give blood, you're going to get some cool things, including admission to our library, as well as Laugh Factory tickets and an appetizer for Chili's. And you will be a hero.
And, Jenny, we're going to put your contact information as well as the Red Cross on the website later today so that people can reference that when they log on to register.
Please do, because there are a limited number of spaces, and if people want to come out and give, I will call the Red Cross and say, hey, send some more folks, because we've got more people who want to give, so we hope that that will happen.
Thank you so much, Jenny. Thanks for your time. Thanks for helping the world be a better place.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome, Jenny. Take care. Goodbye. So again, I know sometimes you're listening on the fly and you can't write things down. We will post it later today at mariasanchezshow.com and latalkradio.com as well. We have a few moments to get into a couple of stories. So this is not the kind of sign you usually see at a park, and it's a Southern California community trying to warn smokers about the perils of smoking. And one of them says they put up a bunch of these signs, which I think it must have been so much fun to be in the meetings where they were creating the 18 signs. Our deer don't smoke in your backyard. Please don't smoke in theirs. Do not throw cigarette butts on the ground. Our squirrels are getting cancer. Smokers will be fed to the bears. So this is happening in a suburb of Glendale, which is in Southern California here. And they were put up in April, and it's throughout the Verdugo and San Rafael Mountains at the Glendale Sports Complex and the Duke Magian Wilderness Park. Smoking is banned on city trails and parks, but the city doesn't have enough workers to patrol every trail, so they're putting up these cute little posters to get people to stop, which I think maybe it might evoke something. So China is in the news for a couple reasons. They have adjusted their exports downward. And they're saying the world's second largest economy may be experiencing their own version of a recession. That's today. But severe air pollution has cut an average of 5.5 years from the life expectancies of those folks that live in northern China. They're saying the toxic air has led to higher rates of stroke, heart disease, and cancer. The study is the first attempt to quantify the health costs of air pollution in their country using data sourced from China itself. Some of the world's most polluted cities are located in northern China. And the reason they're saying is for decades, they offered the folks in the areas north of the river free winter heating. But the free heating was powered by coal boilers, which resulted in the significantly higher levels of population. And you can see thick clouds of smog that have covered the cities like Beijing this year. And it's difficult to remove. Now, when I was in India with Rotary to participate in the National Immunization Days, which was 2 years ago, when we landed in Delhi, you couldn't see the runway until you were right on top of it because the smog was so bad. And then subsequently, when we were assigned, there were about 30 of us that went. We were assigned to in groups of six. So that would be five groups of six. And I had the dubious distinction of being assigned to ground zero for polio, which is a community known as Bareilly, B-A-R-E-I-L-L-Y. So the trip from New Delhi to Bareilly was about 150 miles, and that took us 7.5 hours to get there. And that was because of the concentration of humanity, the varied vehicles that were on the road, everything from cars and trucks and buses to motorcycles with five passengers on it, to tuk-tuks, to scooters, to bicycles. And then, oh yeah, let's not forget the cows and the monkeys and the camels and a giraffe that were also joining us on this road. But the smog was just unbelievable. And to go outside a city and still have it around is because of, there was two reasons. One, part of the industry is to make bricks, and they put them in kilns that have these stacks that go up into the air that's not filtered, belching this black smoke. And I said, you know, you might want to put something on the top there. They go, oh, no, we're far away from the city. It just blows away. And I was like, well, where do you think it blows? It stays here. And then the other reason is that they develop their fuel from cow patties, and they literally take the dung from cows and make it into patties and lay it out in the air to dry. And then that's their source for fuel to cook with, and that's their source for fuel to be warmed by. And you can imagine what that means. So beneath the smoggy clouds in a city in China, over the weekend, opened up the world's largest building. It is in China's fourth largest city. It's 620 miles from the coast, but it has its own shoreline. Now, it's virtual, but it's the biggest building in the world. And it's got a 14-screen IMAX cinema. It has an Olympic-sized ice rink. It has 2 5-star hotels, its own Mediterranean shopping village, and a bunch of offices. It could fit 20 Sydney opera houses beneath its glass roof. It has an 18-story atrium. There is an artificial sea breeze that blows through. It has the largest artificial waves in the world break in front of the longest LED screen in the world. And from one of the most polluted cities in China, the sun shines through the glass barrel vaulted roof to a remarkably blue sky because it's an artificial sun that shines 24 hours a day. So it's one of the largest shopping malls in China. This is the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us. We look forward to chatting with you mañana, and we hope you have a great day. Thank you for listening.
Talking, so call Maria, her show is killer.